the House comes for oral questions. Question number one is in the name of Dr. Duncan Webb.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What reactions has he seen to his announcement yesterday of the government's housing package to back first home buyers?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr. Speaker, those of a positive mindset have seen the positive aspects of the package, and those with a negative mindset are yet to see the opportunities presented. The NZIER says the announcement is a positive move, adding that the government is addressing the rate of return side of the equation to reduce the incentives for investors. Local Government New Zealand says the announcement will be welcomed by communities across New Zealand who have been locked out of the home ownership by property speculators taking advantage of historically low interest rates. And noting the intervention of the Leader of the Opposition, one reaction I haven't seen, Mr. Speaker, is a press release from the National Party who couldn't muster one up.
Supplementary, what other reactions has he seen to the government's move to strengthen the economy by encouraging the building of new homes?
Mr. Speaker, there have been many positive reactions to our moves to encourage the building of new homes. The Real Estate Institute says the fact that new builds are to be exempted from the Bright Line extension is welcome news and could go some way to helping boost the overall supply of housing. Kiwi Bank has said the changes to the Bright Line test exclude new builds is an encouraging move, adding that nudging investor demand into new builds will help boost supply. Mr. Speaker, new builds will be exempted from the Bright Line test extension and the changes to interest deductibility. This will help boost housing supply, which in time will help moderate price rises.
What reactions has his office seen from members of the public?
Mr. Speaker, we've had a number of emails thanking the government for taking action to address the housing crisis. One of them said, thank you, thank you, thank you. Finally, a government who is prepared to tackle housing. Another said, I think that the extension of the Bright Line test and the removal of tax deductibility of interest on mortgages for investors are both game changers, Mr. Speaker.
Question number two, the Honourable Judith Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Prime Minister, does she stand by all of her government statements and actions?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes. Particularly the government's decision to incentivise investment into the construction of new homes and jumpstart developments by funding the vital infrastructure like pipes and transport links needed for new housing.
That's right.
New Zealand's housing crisis, as we've said many times in this House and beyond, has been decades in the making and there is no quick fix. It's an issue that will take time to turn around, but our package of urgent but also long-term changes will increase housing supply, relieve pressure on the market, and we hope make it easier for first-home buyers.
That's right.
Why is she extending the Bright Line test despite Treasury advice that this may put upward pressure on rents when under her government rents have already increased at the fastest rate on record?
Mr. Speaker, the member ignores the fact that Treasury actually advised extending to 15 or 20 years.
Yes, in favour of that.
Obviously, we've settled on 10 as we believe that that's more reflective of the reality in the market. Mr. Speaker, the member herself on occasion has addressed the fact that if you want to help with the rental market, the best thing you can do is ensure supply. That is why we have done multiple things in this package by carving out new builds, making them exempt from interest deductibility changes and also the extension of the Bright Line, and on top of that, making sure that we've got investment in infrastructure.
Has she requested advice on the impact that further rent increases will have on her promise to end child poverty?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, all of the initiatives that we've announced yesterday actually are aimed at doing two things. We want to enable first home buyers to get into the market. But Mr. Speaker, equally, we've constantly had a view to housing affordability across the board, and that means rents. As I've already said, if we want to make a difference to rents, we need more houses. We need general housing supply. Someone who's currently an investor choosing to sell their home doesn't mean that house is suddenly out of the market. But what we do need are additional stable tenancy options for people. And that is why we are focused on seeing that new supply come on stream. And also, Minister for Housing is looking at the market when it comes to specific build-to-rent propositions.
Is she concerned that removing interest deductibility from residential rental properties will result in higher rents being charged to tenants?
Mr. Speaker, one of the things that we've openly acknowledged is that there is a place for investors in New Zealand's housing market. But what we want to do is make sure that we are incentivising those investors in the new builds that we need so that we can see that increase in supply. To answer the issue around those who may already own an investment property, we have tried to smooth the removal of the interest deductibility provisions. We learnt from the UK example. They initially proposed interest deductibility changes that came in all at once for those with an existing property, and then down the track chose to phase it. We have phased it straight off the bat. And we're doing it at a time when interest rates are low to try and reduce the impact on those investors who already have tenants.
Does she stand by her statement this morning to media in regards to her Brightline test changes, quote, it does not apply to the family home, end quote?
Mr. Speaker, yes.
So will her changes to the Brightline test mean that a police officer who undertakes a 2-year posting in another town could now be subject to tax on their family home?
Mr. Speaker, under the policy introduced by the national government, under the policy introduced by the national government for Brightline, there has always been provision for what happens when someone is not living and using a home as their primary home. It was, however, quite crude. It used 50% as the mark. Our view was that you would have, with that rule still in place, some unfortunate and unfair scenarios. Our view was, with the extension, that we needed to be more specific. We've done that, but the change of use rule has always been there, as introduced by National.
Has the law she passed this morning under urgency...
Order. The member will rephrase the question. She knows that's out of order.
Has the law passed this morning under urgency changed the definition of residential property so that farms that include worker accommodation will now be subject to a capital gains tax if sold within 10 years?
Mr. Speaker, one of the things that we've had to address, for instance, is that...
Order. No, I'm not going to let the Prime Minister continue. If the Leader of the Opposition thinks she's got the answer, she shouldn't ask the question.
Point of order.
A point of order, the Honourable Judith Collins.
Mr. Speaker, you've long been of the view stated here that people shouldn't ask questions they don't know the answer to.
Well, that might be the case in court. I just live in hope sometime... In this House, that someone will ask a genuine question. The Honourable Judith Collins.
Supplementary. The Prime Minister, does she stand by her statement this morning that the reason 10 years was chosen was so that the test could apply to, quote, the majority of sales? And does she consider the majority of rental property owners to be speculators?
Mr. Speaker, in answer to the last part of the member's question, no. What I was reflecting was the advice that we had received, which took into account, and unfortunately we don't have the data that delineates between residential and investor, but we know that we see high churn under 10 years. That was the basis on which we received advice from the Treasury to increase. They suggested increasing out to 15 or 20. The reason we chose 10 was based on the evidence that was provided around where that churn was.
Supplementary. When will she respond to my letter, dated 16th March, outlining my concern regarding the conduct of the Right Honourable Trevor Mallard?
Mr. Speaker, I did ask my office to ensure that we had a response to the member. I asked them today to make sure we had a response to the member, so I expect that in the coming days.
Point of order.
A point of order, the Honourable Judith Collins.
I seek leave to table a letter dated 16th of March 2021 to the Prime Minister from myself, including an attachment, including a statement of claim.
I'm just going to ask the member whether that is something that has already been circulated and is on the internet from the member.
Not that I'm aware of, Mr. Speaker.
I have seen it there, but I'll... Is there any objection? Appears to be none. We'll go to question number three. Anahira Kanongataha Sui Suiki.
Kia ora te mana whakawā. He pātai ki te minita o te whanaketanga whare. What recent announcements has she made about supporting first home buyers?
Yesterday I announced increased support for first home buyers. Oh, thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yesterday I announced increased support for first home buyers through the lifting of income thresholds and changes to regional price caps for our first home products. Income caps to get financial assistance will be lifted from $85,000 to $95,000 for single buyers and from $130,000 to $150,000 for two or more buyers. Regional caps have also been increased in areas where the products were becoming increasingly out of reach for first-home buyers.
Pātai Tāpiri, how many people will benefit from these changes?
Mr. Speaker, as a result of these changes, based on modelling, we expect to see 9,300 additional couples and 3,700 additional singles currently renting now qualify for first home products. This builds on the 51,518 first home grants and 4,256 first home loans that we've given out since November 2017. Our focus is on ensuring that first home buyers are given a better shot at owning their own home, and these changes will go a long way to overcoming the deposit barrier.
Pātai Tāpiri, what impact, if any, will these changes have on Māori and Pacific families?
Speaker, increasing income thresholds and changes to the regional price caps will support more Māori and Pacific families into home ownership. Changes to income caps will also support multi-generational households, which are often Māori and Pacifica families. This builds on the change during the government build reset in 2019, when the cap on multiple buyers was removed to allow family and friends to pool deposits and still access first home products.
Question number four, the Honourable Julianne Ginter.
Tēnā koe, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. Does he stand by his statement that, quote, what we are committed to is making sure that houses are more affordable? And if so, does the government have a position on what ratio of median house price to median household income would mean we have affordable housing in Aotearoa?
Speaker, I do stand by my previous statements. Given the multiple factors that determine both house price changes and income growth, I don't want to put a single number on what the right ratio is. But I am clear that it is important that we continue to see incomes lift and we do not see the unsustainable house price rises that we have seen in recent times.
Supplementary, what rate of income growth and what rate of house price growth does he think is realistic?
Mr. Speaker, as I said in my primary answer, we do want to see wages increase, and we have seen wages increase under this government, and that is important. We will continue to push on that. We have information that comes to us via budget forecasts about where the Treasury thinks that will go, and it's been in the order of 3 to 4% recently. We want to keep that going as much as we can. In terms of the house price rises, we will have to see how this package lands, but we are confident that it will lead to a stopping of the unsustainable house price growth that we've seen. But that's why we can't give an exact figure, because we haven't yet seen where the package will land.
Can he confirm that when the government says we need sustained moderate growth in house prices, it's saying we need to wait decades if we have 4% increases in incomes to get back to the level of affordability that we had in 2001?
Mr. Speaker, no. The phrase sustained moderation is one that we have used to highlight the fact that we cannot continue with unsustainable house price rises in the 20% area. On the other side of the coin, we also know that for most New Zealanders, their home, their family home, the only home they own, is their primary asset, and we do not want to undermine the value of that to an extent that would actually lead to further economic shocks to the country.
Does he disagree with the New Zealand Herald editorial, which says, quote, house prices need to fall and sooner rather than later?
Well, Mr. Speaker, as we've said many times, our goal here is to stop the unsustainable house price rises that we have seen. We know, all New Zealanders know, that the situation of the last part of last year does mean that we are seeing first-time buyers locked out. We have announced a package of initiatives that will make sure that things are more affordable. But also we have to recognise that this is a big, complex, long-standing challenge that will require sustained action in order to be able to achieve more affordable homes for New Zealanders.
So if, as he hopes, house prices don't fall from where they are right now, and incomes continue to grow at an elevated rate of 4% a year, is his government happy that it will take at least half a century to get back to the affordability we had in 2001?
Mr. Speaker, the point that I'm making is that house prices and where they go are the function of a number of factors, some of which the government has some control of, some of which the government does not have control of. So it's not, in my view, fair to characterise it the way that the member did. What we are working towards is an environment where first home buyers get a fair go, where we make sure that we encourage investment in new builds, where we make sure that we do have an environment where renters can live in warm, dry, safe housing. All of those things will take time, I acknowledge that, but I wouldn't characterise our policy the way that the member has.
Does he consider affordable housing in terms of both house prices and rent to be a human right?
Sorry, I just missed the end of that.
Does he consider affordable housing, both in terms of rent and house prices, to be a human right?
Certainly believe that on behalf of this government that we believe that every New Zealander should be able to live in a warm, dry, safe and affordable home.
Question number 5, Dean Bennett.
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development and Employment and reads, what reports has she seen about employment in the construction sector?
The Honourable Carmel Cipollone.
Mr. Speaker. One of the highlights of last month's household labour force survey was the year-on-year increase in the number of people employed in the construction sector. There are now 278,000 people employed in the sector, an increase of 21,000 people since December 2019. This increase shows that not only has the construction sector weathered COVID-19, it has rebounded and it is providing more employment opportunities for New Zealanders.
How has MSD worked with the construction industry to prepare job seekers for opportunities in the construction industry?
Mr. Speaker, through MSD's industry partnerships, MSD has worked closely with employers, including in the construction industry, to identify what skills are needed for new employees. Through the Construction Skills Action Plan and Construction Accord launched in 2018, MSD aimed to support 4,000 training and employment places to prepare people to work in the construction industry. We've delivered early on that target, supporting more than 9,300 people taking up education or employment opportunities in the construction sector to date.
What help is available for employers in the construction industry who need staff?
Mr. Speaker, through the Apprenticeship Boost Initiative, employers can access a subsidy of $1,000 per month for first-year apprentices and $500 per month for second-year apprentices. Last week, Minister Hipkins and I announced a four-month extension to this support. FlexiWage is another important initiative which subsidises employees' wages to give employers confidence to take on and train people, as well as to help sustain and grow their business. On top of this, last week I announced a $5.5 million boost for providers as part of Māori Trades and Training. Through working together with industry, we are seeing positive steps forward to ensure we have a workforce ready to meet the demands of the future.
Question number 6, Andrew Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. Does he stand by all his statements and actions?
Mr. Speaker. Yes, including my answer to the member's identical question yesterday.
Why did he tell Mike Hoskins this morning his property tax changes are a reaction to a, quote, very specific set of circumstances? And does this mean he thinks housing has only become unaffordable in the last 6 months?
Mr. Speaker, in answer to the second part of the question, no. In answer to the first part of the question, the member may not have seen the reports throughout 2020 that people expected that the effect of COVID-19 would be a significant reduction in house prices, and the opposite occurred.
Was he aware when he made his promise not to change the bright light line test 6 months ago, house prices had already increased 160,000 since he had been finance minister, and is he seriously trying to justify his broken promise by claiming it wasn't a problem last September?
Mr. Speaker, what I can tell the member is that I think on about the 14th or 15th of September, the Treasury released the pre-election fiscal update, which projected that house prices would be declining.
Why did he tell renters that they could, quote, look elsewhere when their rents went up, and what is his response to Michael, who told the Herald that it was easier to find a job rather than a flat in Wellington?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I think the member is mischaracterising what I said. What I said was, in response to a question about somebody increasing rents by $150 a week as a result of the government's announcements yesterday, that actually there would be a number of factors in why what constructs a rental price. That includes supply and demand and people's ability to pay. What interests me, Mr. Speaker, what interests me in the response of Mr. Bailey and the National Party to this package is that they've clearly chosen their side, and that is the side of speculators.
Question. Oh, further supplementary.
When he said he was too definitive when he promised not to extend the Brightline test, what other definitive promises should New Zealanders now expect him to change his mind on?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, none.
Question number 7, Brooke Van Belden.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister and reads as follows. Does she stand by her statement regarding the government's housing policy that it will, quote, tip the balance in favour of first home buyers through our demand measures?
Mr. Speaker, I stand by my full statement in the House yesterday, which was, quote, the government's decision to support more first-time buyers with a deposit on their first home, tip the balance in favour of first-home buyers through our demand measures, incentivise investment in newly built homes, and jumpstart developments by funding the vital infrastructure like pipes and transport links needed for new housing. New Zealand's housing crisis has been decades in the making, and there's no silver bullet or quick fix. It's an issue that will take time to turn around, but our package of urgent and long-term changes will increase housing supply, relieve pressure on the market, and make it easier for home buyers. End quote.
Supplementary. If the housing market is being rebalanced towards first home buyers, who is it being rebalanced away from?
Mr. Speaker, you can see by what we're trying to do on the demand side that we are trying to reduce some of the demand we've seen by those who are operating in a speculative way. And you can also see that from the recent data, we have had an additional proportion of the housing market taken up by those who identify as investors and by those who have multiple homes already. And so that in the last quarter, my recollection is we're making about 40% of the market. We expect that some of our demand side measures will have an effect there, and that will make it easier for those who are purchasing their own homes.
Supplementary. Will the changes to the Brightline test result in any people who own a single home being taxed?
Mr. Speaker, the purpose of the Brightline test, as it was introduced by National, was to always make sure that if it was the primary home, that it was exempt from the Brightline test. That is the way it was designed. We're continuing with that. We have put extra clarification around the change of use test, which is essentially when someone is no longer using it as their home.
Nicola Willis.
How many more first home buyers does she expect will buy homes over the next 24 months as a result of the policies she announced yesterday? Or would she prefer not to be held accountable to any specific target?
Mr. Speaker, obviously there are going to be a range of factors that will affect the number of first home buyers that are entering into the market. What I can tell the member is that the estimates for just one element of the package, which is the change in caps and income tests for our first home buyer products, will have roughly 9,300 additional couples who will be eligible and up to 3,000 singles who will be eligible. So those are the numbers that we have on just one element of the package.
Three. Is she concerned that changes to the Brightline test will result in fewer homes for sale?
Mr. Speaker, as we've already heard the Revenue Minister talking about previously, if someone is choosing to no longer be an investor in the market, that's not removing the number of houses that are available. The quantum remains the same. What we want to do is get additionality, and that's where we're using incentives to try and encourage those who may want to enter as an investor to buy a new build, and that may, of course, then free up if you're going to an auction or you're in the market. The amount of competition that is in the market already between investors, speculators and first home buyers.
Supplementary. What are the key differences between the Brightline test and a capital gains tax?
Mr. Speaker, I refer back to the National Party's references at the time. I believe John Key said that a capital gains tax would be applied to a property no matter when it is sold, after how long it is sold for and so on. I would also add capital gains tax, as they've been proposed in this country, have been comprehensive. They include small businesses and the like. And finally, what I'd also add is that they certainly don't have the level of exemptions that we have, including around new builds.
The Honourable Dr. Megan Woods.
Has the Prime Minister seen reaction from the property industry, such as Wendy Alexandra from the Real Estate Institute of New Zealand, who said, however, the fact that new builds are to be exempt from the Brightline test is welcome news and could go some way to helping to boost the overall supply of housing?
Mr. Speaker, yes, I've actually seen a number of quotes from different representative bodies supporting the packages we announced yesterday. I'd add to that the president of LGNZ, who said today's announcement will be welcomed by communities across New Zealand who have been locked out of the home ownership by property speculators taking advantage of historically low interest rates.
Why is she rushing tax changes through Parliament without consultation, but is unable to deliver immediate changes to help boost housing supply?
Mr. Speaker, two things I'd quickly say on that. On the legislative changes that help create housing supply, the close example, of course, would be things that we can do to planning and resource management. We actually have already created a fast-track process already. That is in place. We are utilising that, and the member sitting next to you already knows a housing development in his area that is subjected to that, that's the subject of that fast-track process. When it comes to the decision yesterday to put changes to the Brightline test through, we are very aware that changes in this area can cause extra heat in the market. We wanted to avoid that. So both interest deductibility and Brightline changes will apply to houses purchased after the 27th of March. But on interest deductibility, we are consulting on some elements of that to make sure we get the definitions right for new build exemptions.
Question number 8, Barbara Edmonds.
To the Minister of Revenue, why is the government exempting new builds from changes to the Brightline test and interest deductibility rules?
Mr. Speaker.
Dr. Deborah Russell.
On behalf of the Minister, Labor's housing plan will incentivise investment in new build homes, driving development and ensuring more houses are being built. This means that if someone invests in a new build property, they'll be exempt from changes to the Brightline test and interest deductibility policy. This will make investing in new builds a more attractive option for investors and drive demand for new houses, which will help ease the pressure on first home buyers and ultimately help build more houses.
Supplementary. What feedback has he received regarding the government's new build exemptions?
On behalf of the Minister, I have received many positive responses to the new build exemptions. People are recognising that the government has made a deliberate decision with our demand-side measures to tilt the balance towards supply by exempting new builds to encourage investment in building new homes. KiwiBank's chief economist, Jared Kerr, has said that rather than try to get rid of investors entirely, they recognise the fact that they're the ones that do the development. Pouring more resources into new dwellings is incredibly important right now. And even the Real Estate Institute has said that the fact that new builds are to be exempt from the Brightline test is welcome news and could go some way to helping to boost the overall supply of housing.
Supplementary. Will new builds built for the purposes of renting be exempt?
On behalf of the Minister, it is important to clear up some of the misinformation that has been spread by some members in this House. property developers building new homes and or purchasers of new builds will be exempt from the 10-year bright line test and the interest deductibility changes, regardless of what the home is used for. This includes new rental builds purchased investors.
Order. The member's not only addressed the question, she's answered it. Question number 9, Nicola Willis.
My question is to the Minister of Housing and asks, does she stand by her response to concerns that the first home grants and loans caps are too low? Quote, so for the lower quartile, the fourth quartile of that, that is the median point of houses currently that had been sold in March in 2021, quote, if so, how many homes at this price point will the Housing Acceleration Fund aim to get built in the next 24 months?
The Honourable Dr. Megan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I stand by my full response for determining the increase to first home grants and loan caps. They are based on prices in the lower quartile part of the market, which is where many first home buyers are purchasing. I will remind that member that the package has two distinct components, demand measures and supply measures. The member is confusing our government's help for first home buyers with the supply side component of our package. In answer to the second part of the member's question, the intent of the $3.8 billion Housing Acceleration Fund is to increase supply by creating build-ready land for housing to be built on. This is something that councils and developers have told us is missing from the system, and we are acting on it. This fund is there to enable houses to be built. Within the fund, there is an allocation as part of the Land for Housing program to focus on non-market outcomes, such as pace and affordability. The Housing Acceleration Fund will begin making investments in the second half of this year, and work will commence within the next 12 to 18 months. By the end of June, I will take the final design, including criteria, to Cabinet, and I expect the criteria will include a performance framework to measure its success.
Supplementary. What did she mean when she said on Radio New Zealand last night, quote, so what I'm saying is it's based on the data, so what we know is what the four quartiles of housing are. So for the lower quartile, the fourth quartile of that, that is the median point of houses currently that have been sold in March in 2021, so it's based on evidence and it's based on data.
Mr. Speaker, what I meant is exactly that. What I meant is that what we are saying is that we are rolling out an increase to our first home loan products that are based on the lowest quartile of housing prices. This has always been the case with these products. And what I'm incredibly proud of is the fact that our government has been delivering over 16,892 first home grants a year. This compares to National and government, who were only delivering 6,275.
Supplementary. Does she agree with analysis based on Real Estate Institute sales data that only an additional 487 houses would have qualified for the adjusted first home grant scheme had it applied last year? And if not, what is the number?
Mr. Speaker, what I can tell that member is just before I came down to question time, there were over 1,400 homes below the price cap available in Auckland alone.
How can we trust this minister to deliver for first home buyers when in December 2018, the previous Minister for Housing made changes to the first home grant and loan scheme, promising it would fund an additional 230 grants per year, but between then and now, the number of first home grants approved each year has decreased by more than 2,000.
Mr. Speaker, I've already informed that member in answer to a previous supplementary question that this government has been performing at nearly three times the rate of giving out first home grants than the previous national government. We are a government that have prioritised first home buyers and are doing everything to support them, nearly three times more than the previous government did.
Question number 10, Dr. Anai Nehru Leabasa.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Foreign Affairs. What recent announcements has she made about supporting the COVID-19 response across the Pacific?
Mr. Speaker, We're ready to extend manaakitanga across the Pacific if and when called on during these challenging times. We've recently provided support to the government of Papua New Guinea as they confront an outbreak of COVID-19. The New Zealand Defence Force delivered PPE to Port Moresby on last Saturday. Those kits included hand sanitiser, goggles, biohazard bags, sterilising tablets, shoe covers, sharp boxes, infrared thermometers, swabs, gloves, gowns, surgical masks and face shields. We're also making funding available to the New Zealand High Commissioner in Port Moresby to respond to the needs on the ground as requested by partners in Papua New Guinea.
Supplementary. What other support has the Minister provided to support the COVID-19 response across the Pacific?
Mr Speaker, as we observe the increased challenge of a response across the Pacific, we're aware that Timor-Leste has experienced its first outbreak of COVID-19 in the community during the past week. To help the response to escalating health needs, the New Zealand Air Force delivered 4 tonnes of PPE on Tuesday. We've also made emergency funding available to enable the New Zealand Embassy to respond to locally identified needs associated with the outbreak. And these contributions are additional to the COVID-19 related assistance that we provided to Timor-Leste last year, which included the provision of PPE and grants for NGO initiatives to raise community awareness of the disease and reduce lockdown impacts by strengthening food security.
Supplementary. What has been the impact of COVID-19 more generally across the Pacific, and what is New Zealand planning to do to support our Pacific neighbours?
Mr Speaker, our whanaungatanga link to the Pacific means that we are particularly mindful of the economic impact of COVID-19 in the Pacific. While most of the Pacific has avoided the health impacts of the pandemic, economies have been seriously damaged and development gains have been stalled by the closure of borders and the collapse of the tourism industry. There is worrying data and analysis which highlight stark economic vulnerabilities that have been heightened by COVID-19, closed borders, a drop in tourism, impacting sector-dependent businesses. Declining living standards and deepening inequalities will have flow-on effects for the region's long-term resilience. Going forward, we will work alongside Pacific partners to support a resilience strategy as we make further ODA announcements in the near future.
Goros Gaharan.
To the Minister, is her statement regarding the Pacific that, quote, we need to look beyond our own borders in the fight to eradicate COVID-19, consistent with the government's decision not to support relaxing World Trade Organization rules to enable affordable, fair and equitable people's vaccine to the Pacific and globally?
Mr Speaker, yes. We are committed to supporting the Pacific. That is why we have committed with Australia to roll out vaccines across Pacific countries. Our whanaungatanga to the Pacific reinforces our duty of care to ensure that there is the provision of vaccines across the Pacific, and that's why we're working to ensure widespread coverage between us. We're still discussing the TRIPS waiver to the WTO. New Zealand is engaging in this discussion fully, and we're working with countries around the world to broaden the discussion in the WTO to urgently address the manufacturing and distribution of vaccines.
Question number 11, the Honourable Dr. Nick Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Research, Science and Innovation. Does she stand by the government's research and development policies? If so, does she agree with PricewaterhouseCoopers Research and Development National Director that with the new funding system, quote, business would have no choice but to delay projects, in the worst case scenario, cancelling them altogether, and actually having to get rid of highly skilled staff? It's the complete opposite effect of what was intended.
The Honourable Dr. Megan Woods.
Mr Speaker, in answer to the first part of the question, yes. In answer to the second part of the question, no.
Was it the government's intention that 250 software development companies like Orion Health will have cuts of 90% in their support for R&D from the 1st of April as a consequence of her policy changes as stated by Tech New Zealand's CEO Graham Muller?
Mr Speaker, as we went through the design phase of the R&D tax incentive between the initial proposals that were put out and the final design that was legislated, that we worked extensively with the software sector. I think what we do have in New Zealand is that we have a gold standard for an R&D tax incentive for what is permissible in terms of software development. What we will be funding is the creation of new knowledge. What we won't be funding is business as usual coding activities.
Is it the government's intention to cut by 90% research and development in the tech sector? If so, how can that be consistent with the need for strong economic recovery after COVID?
Mr. Speaker, no.
How is it that when the sector raised issues with the definition of R&D support in 2018, did so again with submissions before the Select Committee, that Callaghan Innovation raised these issues last year. Why, 3 years after propose, is this policy in such a mess?
Mr Speaker, I reject the premise of the question, but in answer to one of the many questions that the member asked, actually there was a significant shift between the initial policy that was proposed because of engagement with the tech sector.
What did she do to fix the problem when the specific briefing from Callaghan Innovation said to her last year, digital businesses will lose significant R&D support from the 31st of March 2021? What specifically did
Order,
she do
the member's
to fix it?
Finished his question.
Mr Speaker, as I've told that member across multiple of his supplementary questions, between the original proposal that was set out and the final design that was legislated, there was significant shift in the definition of what software activities could be covered. That is because we listen to the sector.
Question number 12, Helen White.
Mr Speaker, my question is for the Minister of Transport. Is the government helping to keep New Zealand connected with trade partners and maintaining international passenger services? If so, how?
The Honourable Michael Wood.
Mr Speaker, yes. Earlier this week I announced the Maintaining International Air Connectivity Scheme, which will run through until the end of October to help keep New Zealand connected to trade partners and to maintain international passenger services. After the global pandemic hit in 2020 and international passenger flights effectively shut down, the government moved very quickly to establish the International Air Freight Capacity Scheme, which has been critical in supporting our economic recovery and the flow of goods to and from New Zealand, including time-critical goods like medicine. The aviation market will likely start to rebuild later this year, so we've changed and restructured the scheme to focus on recovery. The new Maintaining International Air Connectivity Scheme allows for support levels to reduce as passenger numbers rebuild and has a strong focus on maintaining air links, which will support the recovery of our tourism sector.
Supplementary, what has the scheme meant for New Zealand and for our Pacific partners?
Mr Speaker, as we stand, air freight capacity is currently at 90% of pre-COVID levels, thanks to the scheme that has been in place for the past year. Since May last year, that government support has enabled over 6,000 flights, carrying 120,000 tonnes of air freight in and out of New Zealand, worth $8 billion. More than 60,000 people have returned to New Zealand on flights supported by the scheme, 60% of the total number of people to pass through quarantine's facilities. The scheme has also maintained a critical lifeline for our Pacific partners. There would have been no flights to Tonga, Samoa, Niue or the Cook Islands without it.
Mentory, what reaction has he seen to this announcement?
Mr Speaker, there has been very positive response from the broader sector, exporters, importers, air freight carriers and airports. A few of the examples include the Executive Director of the Board of Airline Representatives of New Zealand, Justin Tighe Umbers, who said that his members are grateful that the government is introducing a scheme that allows airlines to rebuild passenger numbers through freight once borders open. I also note the comments from Lewis Graydon, Chief Executive of Fisher & Paykel Healthcare, who said that without that support over the past 12 months, his company would not have been able to bring in the raw materials and equipment needed to manufacture. And finally, Andrew Tilby, Managing Director of GVI Logistics, says the scheme has been vital for both exporters and importers.
That concludes our questions.